kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual is Cole. Cole, how are you doing today?
I'm alive and kicking. Well, I'm not kicking, but I'm alive.
Why aren't you kicking? What did you do now?
I'm old and I have arthritis.
I thought you did something.
Because no, I didn't do anything.
Normally that leads somewhere. Like, oh, no, I was outside and I tripped and I broke my knee.
I did have to have x-rays on my knee yesterday because that motherfucker's still not healing. So that's fun. That's been like, you know, when did I do that? June.
It's been a while.
Yeah, I don't know. The doctor's like, I guess we can start putting steroid injections in there.
Oh, that's
always
fun.
I don't want to do that.
You know what's more fun than knee injections?
What's more fun than knee injections?
Having company.
We have company.
Yes, joining us from Big Robot, Jim Rossignol. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on.
Did I do okay with the name?
That's great. Yep.
Yes. Yes.
Robots don't need knee injections.
That's true. They don't. They just don't.
But maybe they do, though. Maybe they need, like, all injections.
Well, they do. So they don't get, you
know, like, squeaky.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh, Lord. Jim, you are here to talk about your new game, The Light Keeps Us Safe, coming out this week on Steam. For the people who don't know what this game is, give us the sales pitch.
Okay, so it is a stealth and survival game. This is early access, so this is the first part, the first step in the project, basically. We didn't want to put a gun in the player's hand this time, and so there's a whole bunch of interactions there based on light and using a flashlight that you end up upgrading to produce different kinds of light that allow you to interact with the world in different ways. And as you plunge into the world, you find that it has been taken over by evil light-fearing machines who have done something horrible to the sun and plunged the world outside into perpetual dark. And yes, you have to explore and enter the light, whatever that may be. We're not going to spoil that.
Sounds mysterious as my voice decides to die out for a minute.
Yeah, we're keeping that keeping the whole sort of backstory a little ambiguous, but yeah, it's told by our narrator, the fantastic Louise Stewart, and we're not telling the whole story at the start of early access. That's something that we're going to unfold as we update the game over the coming months.
So you mentioned that it's told with a narrator. Does that mean that the game is more of a linear playthrough?
I mean, it definitely has a structure. It definitely has an overarching structure through it. That said, all the play within it is free form. So all of the maps, you can explore as you wish. They are big, open environments. You can take from any angle. You can spend whatever time you like exploring whatever areas. You will go back to different parts of maps that you couldn't access before. Once you've upgraded your flashlight, the different light types, stuff like that. So it has like a core structure with this, has a central level that we call the bunker, which is a hub level, that allows you to heal and recover from your expeditions, allows you to upgrade your torch, and also allows you to put the light that you find. You discover hidden light motes across the levels, and you put those into a strange dead machine in the center of the bunker, and that begins to wake up. And the story is all structured around that, essentially, yeah.
If machines are trying to murder you, why would you want to bring one to life?
Well, there's some stuff there that has been left behind by the people of whom you were one, and you're the last one left behind. And they've built their own devices to counter the stuff that the machines were doing, and so you find that sort of kitbashed, jury-rigged stuff there left over for you when you come out of your hiding place. And it seems to be how you're going to escape. And so you investigate that line of mystery as the game goes on.
Go ahead, Cole, before I cut you off again.
Well, I lost what I was going to say. Oh, no, I'm good again. You mentioned that, you know, the bunker serving as a hub world and everything. What's the motivation for leaving this bunker for the character and going into this desolate wasteland apocalyptic world if he's got a perfectly good bunker to sit in?
Well, the most pressing issue is that we have some survival elements. So you're running out of food. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, you need to leave and find yourself something to eat. And you could go back in and, you know, just chill out and play some video games. But the machines are slowly infiltrating. They're finding their way in. They're coming down through the walls. It's only a matter of time before they're going to get to you, and so you need to find another way out. And you discover that other humans have entered the light. You're not quite sure what this is, but you have a mysterious narrator who seems to care about you a great deal. She helps you towards that goal. And as things become more desperate, you head outside and beginning to find the bits and pieces that you need to escape to a better place.
That was my next question. The narrator and the player's character are two separate entities.
Yeah,
so will you interact with other like NPCs throughout the world?
No, with no NPCs in the world. You're thoroughly alone with the monsters, basically. Yeah.
That sounds
charming. I'm not sure. Yeah, I was about to say, I'm not sure if that's better or worse. Because at least you don't have to worry about an NPC fucking your world up, but...
No, we've got plenty of monsters for that.
But at the same time, the whole idea of being perfectly alone is equally terrifying.
Yeah, that's the idea.
The gameplay's procedurally generated... Was there any special motivation behind that choice rather than just creating an existing open world that could be explored, you know, and not change?
I mean, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that our last game, The Signal from Tolva, was all handmade, and that was a lot of work. we didn't really want to dive straight back into that. You know, we built like a 4-kilometer map for that. It was a lot of rocks. The other is that Tom Betts, who is our sort of technical lead, he generated little sort of British slices of British countryside for Sir You're Being Hunted back in 2013, and we'd always wanted to return to that as a methodology, because it's not only does it kind of throw up interesting stuff in terms of being able to provide variety for players. But it also creates a really interesting way for us to develop and design stuff, so that we can throw in these variables into the templates we create for the levels and see the effects straight away. And we don't have to wait for a level designer to build them. And it doesn't matter if they work, because you can, you know, you just take the variable out and, you know, something works differently. And there's immense power in that. So we can add entire sections to a map, you know, with a bit of code, and then run them, and 10 seconds later we're running around in it, and it's all laid out. Someone made it. And I think the way that we use procedural generation is very directed as well. We're not using it in the sense that a lot of games, I mean, I think sort of No Man's Sky is a touchstone for a lot of people, and there's very little kind of sort of directed design in that, because of course it's a whole planet. So you don't tend to have roads running through it. You don't tend to have that kind of like built structure and so on. But the way we do procedural generation is to make sure that we drop that in there. So there are roads running through all our levels, and they do connect points of interest. And there is a logic to it that people will understand is the real world. I mean, we've even had discussions internally in a kind of like, do we even really want to talk about the procedural generation stuff that much? Because, you know, it creates expectations that I just don't think are necessarily true of the game. And certainly we had the first round of players that we had come test it. We didn't say anything to them about that. And, you know, they were sort of pointing out, you know, a few what they assumed were editing problems with the map. And I was just like, oh, no, that's just the, you know, that's just the algorithm messing up. And they hadn't clocked that it was procedurally generated at all, because they were looking for the kind of cues that you see in hand-built stuff, you know, those points of light that you're supposed to head to for the next thing, those little sort of signposts of design that say, hey, this way. That stuff is still in there from the way that we put stuff together. And I just think that's we find that a really interesting way to work, a really fun way to develop. And so we were keen, after having done some stuff with Sir, and of course, having learned tons from that and sort of said, hey, if we could do it again differently, how to do it differently. Of course, we've got a chance to do that now. And so we've been able to do a whole bunch of stuff differently. In some ways, some of the challenges and stuff in this game are logical extensions of the stuff that we did before. So one of the things that Tom used to complain about was that the sort of MacGuffin that you collected in Saving Hunter didn't have quite enough sort of challenges between you and it. We tended to have some AI guards, and maybe it would be in a strange place that you would have to track down. But this time we've layered that up, so there could be force fields that you'll need to deactivate by finding a trigger somewhere else in the structure, and then there may be tripwires and booby traps inside, and all that stuff layers up. And of course, that's all randomized as well. So whenever we go into one of our own buildings, we're always playtesting it for the first time. We're never quite sure, you know, what the layout's going to be and how those things are going to try and get us. And that's just super fun to test and develop. And then hopefully people enjoy it as well when they come to replay. I mean, I think that sort of reflects in our decision to take this early access as well, because as this is right at the start of the project. With an approach like this, we're able to throw in a whole bunch of new stuff. And when you do your playthrough, it's all fresh, not just because there's new features in there, but because it's a new map. You know, it's a layout you've never seen before. It will be fresh each time. And I think that's really powerful. And that kind of speaks to the whole decision as to why we went that route.
It sounds like getting that algorithm to work properly seems like so much more work than just designing something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a lot of work, but you know, on the flip side, it's something that we already have loads of expertise in. It's something that Tom has spent, you know, thousands of hours at this point in mastering. And so when we got the prototype down, the functionality of creating a world that could populate forests and junkyards and streets with buildings on and stuff, that was all down pretty quickly. It's really down to, you know, the time is in the finessing of it, you know, like finding those edge cases. You know, why does that car poke into the road in the wrong way? You know, why is this stuff not being placed? And then, you know, Tom spends a lot of time, you know, in the engine of that, just tweaking it and fixing it up. And, you know, to some people, they run straight past that bug, that error, you know, that we've seen. And never notice it. And then other times it will throw a tree into the middle of a building, and we'll be like, damn, you know, shouldn't have done that. But it is work, but it's something that, you know, we have enthusiasm for. And you know, it's one of those things, you know, it's great to play to your strengths. And I think it, you know, when you're doing something that you know you can do a great job of, the inertia is just straight there. You know, we knew that we could create a world using this tech very quickly. You know, we created it. We had a concept way before even the light concept itself. So the light interaction concept was just a little yellow post-it note on my wall next to my desk for a couple of years. Just that name. And I, you know, at the time, I'd imagined some kind of light collecting wizard, maybe. I don't know. Like it was just an idea that I hadn't even attached to anything. And then after we had generated this terrifying, spooky, bleak road that had ghosts appearing along it and was very threatening, and suddenly I just looked at that and clicked and thought, that's the other layer. That's the thing that we can fold into this terrifying, gloomy world that we're now generating. And can have a really cool gameplay loop that opens up and that we can build on top of. And it's one of those things where it just all clicked, and one thing implied the next thing, and the thing designed itself, which is, you know, that's always useful.
I'm one of those players. No, Joe, you're going to hold on a second.
I was just going to say, so there's no wizards in the game.
No wizards. No, not yet.
There's always the potential. It's early access. Mm-hmm. But... I'm one of those players who would like see the car sitting sideways in the road or something where it shouldn't be, or the tree in the building. And I would like spend 2 hours looking at it because I'd be convinced it was trying to tell me something important that I just didn't understand.
Yeah. Well, we'll try and avoid that as much as we can. Yeah.
Like I would just sit there and be like, there's a nut I need to pick up or something. There's a reason this tree is here. I need it. And I'm hoping we've
signposted that stuff to it clearly enough that you won't get floored by those sort of errors.
Especially in horror games, I'm 10 times worse in a horror game because everything is trying to tell you a secret message when it's trying to scare you.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
When it comes to the biomes, you said junkyards and forests, but how many different kinds of environments did you guys create? It's okay if you count on your fingers. I would have to.
So, sorry. How many have we got live now in the game?
I know that you have a roadmap as well for like future plans for additional ones.
So. We have 4 up and running at the minute. I think only 3 are going to ship because I want to hold the 4th one back because we're going to patch something in pretty fast at the start. And we posted a couple of different screenshots of that. But yeah, we'll have 3 in the game there from the start. But then within that, I think the sort of the way that we've made it is so that there's like a world theme, so that there'll be like a lighting theme, which one of them is sort of a sort of very gloomy night, another one's very sort of toxic-y swamp, for example. And within that, I have like a template that I can design levels with that. Instead of physically laying out the level, I kind of just put the elements I want in there. So I can mix up any of the stuff that we've made for any of the environments together and see how they work. So I've got a whole bunch of like crumbling, weird, like semi-industrial buildings that we laid out for the first one. But, I found equally using those as solitary points of interest in like a kind of much flatter swamp works well too. So we've been able to pollinate between the environments, which means that in essence they're all kind of one continuous environment, like the sort of color and the kind of the theme is the thing that probably sort of gives the whole thing its overall flavor. But then all of the environments that we've got are able, through the fact that we're proceduralizing them, it's sort of continuous, like one thing feeds into the next. You might see stuff from a previous environment in this one. You might see it very different because we've colonized it with a whole bunch of machines and traps and weird stuff that the machines have put in there. And so you get this kind of sense of continuity and as well as a sense of difference as you move between the levels. So it isn't really, there's no real hard line between those different environments. They are, there's 3 good ones in there that are defined by theme. But yeah, there's a lot of other stuff and also I've tried to randomize it as well to make sure that, if you do play through again immediately, you'll see some different stuff as you go through.
I'm just waiting for Cole. I don't want to get yelled at.
It's okay. You can go. I'll yell at you anyway.
What made you go with a world of eternal night?
I think we were just in a bit of a bleak place. Oh no, I know exactly what it is actually. So, after we did the thing from Tolva, we were sort of thinking. I mean, when we've done games in the past, we've basically had a big idea at the start and just gone, okay, cool, we'll make that. And we've just then sat down for 2 years and, done that thing. This time, however, we thought, well, let's just play around with a whole bunch of stuff. And so we prototyped some stuff. And we just made a couple of different things. And we looked at some stuff that Tom had messed around with over the past couple of years. And we actually started making a kind of like factory game for a while, with sort of a whole kind of like Factorio thing in mind. But after getting stuck into the sort of, numbers and numbers and numbers, I just said to Tom, I think this is just, I can't do this for a couple of years. So we went back to the drawing board and one of his ideas was he created this really gloomy, kind of scary, spooky laboratory. And again, he'd done this sort of randomized, so it essentially built its own architecture. So it was like a, kind of labyrinthine laboratory with horrible things growing in it and weird anomalies pulsing and stuff. And I said, well, this is great. This is the perfect theme. And then when we built built sort of an exterior environment connected to it. It was just really, really gloomy. And we called it the Bleak Road, and that became our first environment for the game. And it just seemed to make sense to run with the sort of the dark, you know, the threat of just darkness off the side of the road. And just keep going with that. And it was really, really dark at one point. The game is practically daytime compared to how it was 6 months ago. I'm going to post some screenshots of that actually at some point, because it was just fantastically dark and threatening at one point. But it also became kind of unnavigable, you know, so that you were just stumbling around. As soon as you got off the road or away from any streetlights or anything, you were just stumbling around in complete pitch black. And yeah, it didn't quite work. But the idea and the feel of it, yeah, that just stuck with us. And it, yeah, again, it was just one of those things that organically came out of mucking around. Yeah.
And then what led to light being the power of the game?
I think I'd had that this sort of idea that was up on the post-it note for a while, and yeah, I'd imagine quite a different game, I think. But I talked to Tom about it, and you know, we'd done a couple of games where, you know, that had combat in, had shooting and stuff, and I said I just kind of want to sidestep that. You know, we need something that the player can interact with the world with, but I don't necessarily want it to be another gun. And Tom agreed, and he said, well, you know, we already have a flashlight because it's this, you know, it's this scary game, you know, and then suddenly it clicked. Ah, the light keeps you safe. You know, you can
like
hide
the name in the light. Of the game.
Right. So, that you know, you can hide, you know, in a kind of like inverting your classic stealth game, you don't need to hide in the shadows. You can hide in the streetlight and the things can't get you. And so, you know, we extended that to the flashlight itself. You use that to dazzle or scare baddies away. And, you know, at that point, you know, we had something to build on. We had something to work with. It was a tool that we could extend, that the player could use to influence stuff in the world. And it just sort of naturally snowballed from there. And we did a lot of just making stuff this time, you know, and doing it very crudely, you know, not really worrying too much about how it looked, you know, lots of sort of programmer art, just spending time mucking around with stuff, making sure that, you know, we'd explored some avenues. And we still have those kind of like all that stuff ready to be made pretty by artists and then to develop that into a bigger thing. Yeah, I think it just kind of made sense, not least because, you know, we had kind of bought into this murky, bleak, gloomy aesthetic, but also because it allowed us to explore a whole bunch of game systems that weren't shooting, weren't, you know, throwing grenades or using force shields or all the other stuff that we've already done in a bunch of other games that lots of other people have done too, let's face it. Yeah, it was fresh and it was cool and it was a thing that totally made sense with a kind of a survival and a horror genre.
And as bleak and dark as the game is, it is stunning to look at.
Thank you. Just
the use of colors in the game with like green skies and the red light of the monsters, it is just a stunning game to watch.
Thank you. I mean, I think one of the things one of our strengths really is Ollie Skillman Wilson, who's our main 3D artist. His real love and his real specialization is in lighting. And Tom, our technical lead, his artist his background is as an artist. So he trained as an artist before he was a programmer and then learned to program so that he could use computers to make art. And the two of them working together create these, you know, these beautiful environments very quickly. And, you know, Ollie is one of those guys who has incredible artistic talent, but also a real kind of like he's read the manual, you know, he knows how to do stuff. And he understands how a lot of tech works in a way that, you know, the rest of the development team doesn't. And I'm sure lots of other developers, you know, don't either, because his ability to pick stuff up and say this will work in this way has been brilliant, you know. And it was, you know, simple stuff that I think everyone's aware of, like volumetric lighting. He's picked that up and just, you know, made it fit the game beautifully, and the results are, you know, really striking and really clear. Yeah, as I think you've seen.
I was only able to put a little bit of time into the game myself. I have a notoriously awful computer, So I was just dealing with a lot of technical issues on my end. There was nothing wrong with the game at all. It's just my computer sucks. So I am dying to put more time into this game, and I got to know, are there any console plans for it?
Well, plans, yes. Anything we can confirm, no. We've had we had some really nice discussions with the Xbox guys last year. We have a couple of dev kits sat under the desk. They've had a bit of use last year. They're going to have some more use this year, but that's all I can say so far. Yeah,
because I think this would be an awesome game for the Xbox game preview program.
We agree. But we'll see how that goes. Yeah.
You mentioned the upgrading your flashlight in the hub world, and that there are some survival elements to this game. But you guys have chosen to leave crafting out, which usually kind of goes hand in hand with the survival aspect. What was the reasoning behind that? And
mostly because you wanted to keep the pace up. We're not really super interested in like having to collect a whole bunch of resources and the whole kind of like farming aspect of having to know where the stuff you need to collect is and going back and get it and stuff. You know, I personally enjoy that enormously in games, but it wasn't something we wanted to do for this. I think this is much more about keeping the momentum up, keeping you feeling, keeping things feeling tense, feeling like you're being hunted by the machines. It just wasn't a direction we want to go in. That said, my plans are to overhaul the whole loot and way in which that we use survival in the game in the coming months. But we wanted to create a framework that was simple and gave you, you know, an immediate momentum. You know, you've got to find stuff. You've got to find, you know, things like bottles to throw to distract your enemies. You've got to find stuff to eat. You need to find bandages and meds and stuff to patch yourself up. And that's, it doesn't go a lot deeper than that at the minute, because that's all the framework we needed to get you into the action part of the game. It is something I do want to expand. And I've got some plans to expand it in some interesting directions, I think. And then some of that will be some unusual stuff that I don't think people have really seen in this kind of game before, but we'll come to that. We'll get to that in the next couple of months.
I heard you about to start talking, Cole. I'm always just scared.
I was just breathing. It's okay.
Okay.
Sometimes I have to breathe, Joe.
How long are you anticipating being in early access?
I mean, the stuff we've got sort of scheduled out now will be 6 to 8 months, and we'll just see how it rolls after that. It could go much longer. I think we did 9 months and then another sort of 6 months for a multiplayer expansion on Sir. So, you know, it would be amazed if we didn't do that kind of arc, basically. Yeah. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. And also, you know, you mentioned earlier that anything goes in early access. We're definitely freer in this early access. With Sir, we made a whole bunch of promises in the Kickstarter, and we executed all of those promises, you know, every single last one, all the stretch goals and stuff. And we were super proud of that. But at the same time, that created a template we had to fill out. And this time we're much freer because we have this idea, but it could go anywhere. And you know, and I can't wait to see what people suggest and, you know, what people's feedback to it is, because that may change the direction that may change the length of time we end up developing it. We'll just have to play it by ear and see how that goes.
Does it feel more freeing being able to just plan the game as you go instead of having all these restrictions that you would have to follow?
I mean, it's more daunting, right? You know, because it's, we don't necessarily know where we're going with it. I think it was really cool to have the sort of inspired moment of say being hunted and being able to see exactly how it was all going to work and being able to, you know, everything implied everything else. And it was just, you know, we did this Kickstarter and it made sense in a really interesting way almost from day one. This time it is freer, definitely, because we're feeling our way through it. That's exciting in a completely different way because I think we knew at the start of Sir, You're Being Hunted how it would look at the end. This time, I don't think I necessarily know how it looks going to look at the end, and that's exciting and a bit scary.
Is the story fleshed out completely, or is all that still up in the air as well?
Yeah, that is pretty tight, actually. I'm pretty sure I know what I want to do with that. And we have actually done a whole bunch of voice recording to use in that. We'll be feeding into the game in the next couple of updates. I'm pretty certain about how I want that, because I have a cool twist that I want to drop, but we'll see how that goes.
You tease.
Mm-hmm.
Call anything on your end?
I have a whole list of things. I'm still going. I'm sorry.
Oh, go for it.
You keep mentioning, sir, you're being hunted and Signal from Tova. And I was just curious how fans of those games might find that The Light Keeps Us Safe is either similar or different. I asked a hard one. I'm so proud.
can you say it again for me?
Fans of your other games going to find that The Light Keeps Us Safe is maybe radically different from them, or are they going to find that it's something they're familiar with?
I think it really feels like one of our games. Mm-hmm. And you know, people who have played a whole bunch of our games before have said that, you know, you can see how we've slotted things into similar places, but it's a new world, and it's got a new thing to it, basically. The core loop of it is very different. Mm-hmm. It's both more open in some ways, certainly than Tolva, but tighter in others, in that, you know, you can spend a lot of time just exploring randomly. But, you know, when you need to get into a house, you need to have a plan, you need to distract the turret, you need to make sure the thing that's guarding it has wandered away, or you've lured it away already, you need to deal with the booby traps and the other perils and stuff that, there's some stuff there, basically. And I think it's closer to So You're Being Hunted, you know, and we've got some stuff in there that I think works very like So You're Being Hunted. We have a huge, terrifying spider-like airship that appears in one of the later levels. And that was inspired in part by a balloon that we had crewed by our enemy robots in So You're Being Hunted. And it was one of our favorite things in that game, because as soon as we added it, it became visible across the whole level. And you could see it searching around with a flashlight, or a sort of searchlight underneath the balloon. And then the sense that you were being hunted increased enormously for just adding that one character to the game. And so, you know, it was one of those things that we knew we'd done right and wanted to revisit and do, you know, have a similar effect. And so the airship that we introduce in this it works very differently and is much more dangerous than the balloon in Sir. But yeah, it has a very similar touchstone, and people who have played both games have gone, hey, you know, that does a similar thing. Whoa, it's much scarier. And that's been really fun to see, and really fun to work with. I think there's a whole bunch of stuff that we do in terms of the atmosphere of games, the kind of music that we do. You know, we tend to be very we have quite a light touch with stuff. We don't tend to be too directed. We don't, you know, we never have any cutscenes, really. We never you know, if we do have any kind of cutscene setup stuff, it's brief, and it doesn't railroad you too much. I think the stuff we did in Tolva was probably it was a few seconds of a robot chatting to you, and that was the most in-depth stuff we've done in that, because we just want to get people into exploring the world, and that's the thing we want to spend the most time developing. And I think showcasing an environment in a spooky way is, you know, that's become our sort of brand, I guess. And yeah, so people who have played the previous games are going to recognize that, while I think finding themselves exploring something that doesn't feel quite like either of the previous games.
How many nightmares do you see yourselves creating for people with this game? because this is just nightmare fuel for me, and I love it.
I think, I think my nightmares are always about sort of anxiety about deadlines and stuff like that. So, you know, hopefully none of those kind of nightmares. it is scarier than our previous games, That said, some people were just genuinely terrified of some of the stuff that happened in So You're Being Hunted. So we'll see if we can beat that and instill some more bad dreams, but, you know, in a good way.
The more we talk and you keep mentioning about Sir being hunted, you're being hunted, being scared too, the more I'm just like, I really need these to come to Xbox. I really do.
Yeah, I mean, we spent a bunch of time working on whether we could get Serve to Xbox. And in the end, it was a bunch of technical stuff that stopped us. There are just certain kind of things that consoles do in terms of how they constrain how a game can work and how it can use the system that aren't a problem on a PC. And yes, Sir was chock full of that stuff, so it made it impossible to take it any further. But with Light, I think the engineering is a little different, so we'll see where we go.
So there's a little bit of a glimmer of hope for people who are on console.
Yeah, oh, definitely this time. We'll in fact, I have a meeting about it next week, so we'll see where that goes.
Hearing Cole's joy as you mention a meeting.
I was actually like whining to Joe yesterday. Was it yesterday or was it earlier today? I don't even remember what this week is anymore. But I was basically like, there just haven't been enough horror games this year, and I need more.
Yeah, it's been oddly light, hasn't it?
On horror this year. Well, because we're getting ready. I don't know if I'm even supposed to mention this yet. Oh well, we're getting ready. Yeah, we're getting ready to do the Halloween giveaway for the show that we do annually, and so you know, Joe gets a bunch of scary games to give away, and he's like, "Oh, well, we need your ideas for the scary games to put into the giveaway bundle." And I'm like, "But there weren't that many this year." And I'm sitting here like rambling off all these games, and they were last year. And he's like, "Nope." Nope. Oh,
shit. Yeah, that's a tricky one.
That was a bit of a tangent. I'm sorry.
no problem.
I'm prone to those. And then I lost my place in my notes, too, because I got off on that tangent.
Were you doodling again?
I was totally doodling. I made like a whole total little like ink picture down here. I'm so proud of myself.
That's good. It's good to doodle.
I cross-hatched and everything. Yay, me.
It's nice that you keep yourself busy during interviews.
I have to keep my hand busy, or otherwise, if you think I get distracted and lost now.
Oh, Lord.
It would be a million times worse if I was just sitting here staring while we did.
So off the topic of the game for a little bit, what kind of games are you looking forward to this holiday season? There's so much stuff coming out in the next few months. Anything on your radar that you're looking forward to?
It's going to be Red Dead Redemption 2 for me, I'm afraid. I haven't sunk much time into open world games for a while, actually. I can't quite remember the last one that I really spent a lot of time with, but the first Red Dead Redemption was something that just ate me alive. And I can't wait for that to happen again. You know, I just, I hope I have enough time with everything else we've got going on to really sink in hugely that. As for other stuff, since I stopped being a games journalist, it's been really interesting to be surprised by games. And I expect it'll be something that I pick up in this sort of rush that we'll get now between now and Christmas, that will really, you know, sort of make the most of my time. The game that we've been playing internally in the studio is Crytek's Hunt Showdown, which is multiplayer, again, Cowboys, actually. Cowboys versus the Supernatural. And we've had an amazing time with that. And that's an early access and being updated at the moment. And I'm super interested to see where they go with that, because it's done some stuff that I've really enjoyed and I'm really excited about. And I think the sort of tone of it, and the tension of it, and the way it mixes PvE with PvP is just pitch perfect. I think I would go as far as to say I think it's the best thing Crytek have done. And I'm super excited about seeing what they do with it in the coming months.
That is some high praise.
Mm.
Could that inspire any kind of multiplayer aspect to the Light Keeps Us Safe?
No, we definitely won't do any multiplayer on Light. We know that because we do have plans for something multiplayer in the future. And also we did multiplayer expansion on Sir, which was amazing, and people still play it now, and it's one of the best things that we've made. But it was such an education in how multiplayer stuff works, and also what we want to do with multiplayer and how we would want to do that if we did it again. That, yeah, we have some very specific ideas about that, and it definitely doesn't fit with the way Light currently works. We'll definitely stick with the single player plan for this one. Yeah.
I feel like a game titled Sir, You're Being Hunted was just begging for a battle royale mode.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, the multiplayer game is sort of works like that. It's the function of it is essentially a battle royale, but against the robots. So you can work together up to a point to get the teleporter to take somebody home at the end, but only one person can go home. So at some point you turn, and you know that created a really cool dynamic. As I say, it's one of my favorite things that we've done. I think it was a really cool design, and yeah, that will definitely inform multiplayer things that we will be interested in delving into in the future.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a pretty creative element, because there are other games like that. Like the survival DLC for The Division gives you the option to work together, but everybody's just an asshole and immediately turns on you. So
yeah, I think it's like the asshole point, isn't it? Like at what point does that happen in your
right
game? If it's straight away,
like there's a game where there's a time limit where you have to work together at least a little.
Yeah.
Before you get to go full blown asshole.
Yeah, I mean, the hunt kind of mixes that up, but yeah, you pretty much have to work together to kill these bosses, and then after that, yeah, it becomes a little more ruthless. I think we're super interested in that kind of dynamic in a game, and we'll see where we are in a year's time. But I would love to explore that kind of concept a bit more in the future.
Nice. Are you a fan of true co-op gameplay, or are you more of a fan of the asshole co-op gameplay?
I like both. I played a lot of EVE Online over the years, which has some of the most brutal kind of player versus player stuff I've ever encountered, and I got a lot out of that. So, you know, read into that what you can about my character.
Oh man, Cole, did you have any other questions?
No, I think I'm finally good.
You good with your notes?
Yeah, I went through and like made X's on everything that I asked, and there's a lot of X's.
Nice, because I know we've been chatting for a while. Jim, was there anything about the game that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
I just, you know, if people are interested, I would say, you know, go over and have a look at our Steam page, check out the roadmap, check out the videos. There's going to be a whole bunch of stuff streamed and videoed and generally put out over the next couple of days. So, you know, if you're interested, wish lists, and I would say this about all games that you want to support and that you're interested in on PC, wish listing is super important to the ecosystem, particularly for indies. So if you are interested in a game, please do wishlist it on Steam. And, you know, if that happens to be our game, then big thumbs up. That would be really cool.
What does wishlisting do to affect
wishlisting games? Wishlisting basically emails people on the release of that game. But a lot of what Steam has done in terms of promotion and you know, its internal algorithms for promotion of, you know, tracking games that are popular and stuff, that's done through wishlisting. So for games that are trying to get attention, for games, you know, and we all know there are a lot of games out there, you know, trying to get in the limelight. If you want to support a game, the best way is to wishlist it on Steam right now in terms of what you will do for it, in terms of its position on Steam and how more eyes will end up on it. So that's why it's important to us. Yeah.
I've always wondered, but I figured I would ask.
I know.
where can people keep up to date with you and what you're doing and what Big Robot's doing?
Well, if you're a Steam user, there is our creator page, all the updates for all the things going with our games. And there are some more updates coming for other games, actually, in the next few months. So you can follow us on the creator page. The best place, though, and where all our information is first is on our Twitter, which is BigRobotLTD. So if you follow us on there, then, yeah, that's the best place to keep up to date.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, cool. Jim, where can people get the game? How much is it? Give us all the details.
So the game will be out in 2 days' time. That's the 11th of October. That will be, I think that's 10 a.m. Pacific time. And that will be $20, but there is a 15% discount for the launch period, which I think is a week or 10 days, something like that. So getting in at the start is definitely a good idea.
Awesome. That is always the best way to do it. Discounts are good for everybody.
They sure are. And we hope lots of people will take advantage of that in the coming week.
Well, I hope so as well, because if it does well on Steam, I'm guessing that means better chances for a console version, which...
Absolutely, yes.
We're fans of.
Yeah, I was about to say, if launch discounts are good for everybody, but they're better on Xbox, so, you know.
Well, let's hope we see a launch discount on Xbox in the coming year.
Well, if there's any news on that, be sure to keep us posted.
We'll make a lot of noise about it.
I intend to be one of those assholes that follows you on Twitter and just randomly is like, Xbox, every time you post about the game.
Cool.
There's always that one guy.
What's that? Yeah. There's several of those now.
Usually there's somebody, too, that says Switch, but I don't have a Switch, so that's going to have to be Joe, but I'm totally going to be there like, Xbox, every time.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely won't be on Switch.
But. They're going to flop me.
Yeah, I couldn't see this working on Switch too well.
Yeah, I think we would struggle.
Just a little. But Jim, it was a pleasure having you on the show, chatting with us. Everyone else, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more show in a little bit. Jim, do you have any final words to end this?
I just want to say thanks to you guys for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another thanks to Jim at Big Robot for joining the show and chatting with us. We do have a lot more show to take care of, a lot of games to talk about. We are starting things off. Norg, you're here. How are you doing, buddy?
Hi.
How's things?
Oh, things are great. That was me trying to play the first song you hear in The Bard's Tale 2 when you first load up the game.
Look at you, dropping references.
It actually almost happened until my fingers got tangled up, and then I remembered that I don't know the fingering for the rest of the song. Whoops!
Oh, you.
Yeah.
Oh, you. By the way, I wanted to thank you on the show for your incredible Up in Smoke cover on the last episode.
Yeah, it was great, man.
Dude, it was so good. It was such a good song.
Dude, you know that cough halfway through? That was legit, and I left it in there. I got tangled up in that scratchy voice thing and just started hacking. So I left the cough in there because it sounded authentic. And now my voice is totally shot because that last sip of LaCroix went down the wrong windpipe, you know?
LaCroix.
Yeah, man, oh man. There's like some kind of class action lawsuit against them right now. I don't know what that's all about.
Really? For what?
They say that the natural ingredients that are in there aren't actually natural ingredients. And so there's like a class action lawsuit. And I've seen all kinds of comments that go back and forth either way saying, wait, no, yes, they are natural ingredients. And it's hard to tell. I can't tell if it's some dude with an agenda or if there's actually something to what they're talking about. So I guess it'll play out in the long run, I suppose.
Those sons of bitches.
In the meantime, I'm going to continue drinking this natural lemon-flavored sparkling water, LaCroix.
I am drinking a Kmart brand half-and-half black tea and lemonade.
Dude, that sounds delicious. Is that like an unleaded Arnold Palmer?
Pretty much, yeah.
That sounds awesome. I'd be in on that.
I love Arnold Palmers. They are so good.
They really are. They're so refreshing, and then you just crack one open on a hot summer day. Oh, my goodness.
But yeah, Kmart sells a 12-pack of 20-ounce bottles for $4.
Shut up! Really?
So I jumped on it, and I tried it, because I didn't know if it would be good or not, because, you know, it's a knockoff brand.
But, right.
It's pretty damn good, so I've been buying it since.
It's too bad they closed most of our local Kmarts. I would get on that.
I figure the 5 calories in the bottle of this is much better than the 4,000 calories in a can of soda.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if you're going to weigh and compare or count calories or some crap.
I'm fat. I have to.
So am I. And that's why I'm drinking 0 calorie natural lemon flavored sparkling water, LaCroix. Instead of the 4,000 calories in like a cider or something.
This episode of the SML podcast brought to you by LaCroix.
Is it carcinogenic? We don't fucking care.
Oh, God. I love when you're on the show, George.
Sup, yo. I love being on your show. I need to do it more often.
You do. It is such a blast when you're here because things just go off the rails.
Completely.
I am expecting your review to go incredibly off the rails.
Dude, this can I tell you a story? I know I've told you this story before, but I want an opportunity to tell it to like everybody who's listening.
Sure.
So check this out. I think I was somewhere between the ages of 10 and 12, and I was an avid Commodore 64 user, and I still remember the day that I brought a metal chair down to the front door and sat by the front door of my house waiting for the UPS person to show up with my cash on delivery package.
Oh, so that COD.
COD, baby. That's how far back this goes.
Damn.
Because so that I could finally play and have my own copy of The Bard's Tale, Tales of the Unknown. And of course, failure to be at the front door when the UPS person arrived would likely mean missing the delivery, and there was no way I was going to risk that. Because, you know, back in those days, they would lightly rap on the door and then run away fast so that they wouldn't have to actually deliver the package.
It'd be like a... Hello? Never mind, bye.
Is anybody home? No, okay, bye. Yeah, pretty much. So I sat there all day until the delivery showed up in the late afternoon, and then finally got the game up and running, made my first party, ventured into the mean streets of Scarabray, and party wiped within 5 minutes. Low-level characters starting out had a very low rate of survival, and I'm sure to any adults who were playing the game at the time, that was part of the fun. As a kid, it was frustrating as hell, but that did not stop me. And I kept at it, made new parties, and eventually discovered that if you used the pre-made parties barred, you could steal the Firehorn off of it. On the Commodore 64, though, you didn't see how many uses the Firehorn had. So I thought this was an unlimited use item, and I would just sail around town, blowing the stuffing out of anything I ran into. And then I thought, okay, here we go. I'm climbing through the sewers. I'm doing great. And I come up against like a whole bunch of like zombie type characters, and I go to use the Bard's fire horn because I'm on this, and it's gone.
What happened?
Well, in the Commodore 64 version of the game, it didn't show you the fact that there was actually a usage count for that item, and I exceeded the usage count for that item. And when you exceed the usage count for that item, it disappears, and I party wiped.
Oh no. Did you save recently?
No, see, that's it. If you die out in the wilderness, you're basically gone. Which again, that was considered to be part of the fun. But I kept going, I recreated. I don't remember how I did it, but I somehow managed to restore the original default party so that I could steal the Firehorn again, and I was a little I was a little more conservative with its use, for lack of a better description. And I remember just plowing through, mapping, finding out that you could repeat the Berserker room in the castle and just build up characters like crazy at that point. It's worth noting, though, that the Berserker repeat has been removed from the remastered original trilogy. That's how much of a nerd I am for Bard's Tale stuff. Wow. But yeah, manually mapping everything on graph paper, continuing on to the second game, and being a kid and completely shocked at finding out who the bad guy actually was at the end of the game. And then the just total frustration of basically having to start over in Bard's Tale 3, because in Bard's Tales 1 and 2, all of your stats capped at 18, strength, intelligence, wisdom, charisma, luck, all that stuff. In the Bard's Tale 3, as far as I am aware, they either didn't cap or they capped at like 99 or something. So when I transferred my extremely high level characters from Bard's Tale 2 and their low stats, they didn't have a prayer of surviving. So I had to start over.
Oh, man.
Which was fine. I got the full meal deal experience on that one. But there was really no point in transferring characters, because high-level characters from Bard's Tale 2 were stat-limited. And then you get a level 63 warrior into Bard's Tale 3, and you have 7 million experience points before your next level. so that you can get 19 on your luck instead of, like, huge amounts of stat by the time you get to the higher levels. Anyway, so I've been literally waiting a generation practically for the opportunity of an actual successor to that series, and that was to be the Bard's Tale 4. We don't talk about the cutesy one that showed up on Xbox with the top-down view and the fantastic dialogue, but That was not the same. It had the name, but it didn't have the thing.
That's like the only one I'm familiar with, too. So
really?
I'm sure you hate me right now.
No, I played it for a while, and it wasn't what I was expecting, and I just stopped because it wasn't what I was expecting. For the review, I did everything I could possibly do to remove the nostalgia glasses and give the game kind of a unbiased review. So I'll do my best. It's hard to put an entire childhood's worth of experience to the side and not let it bias my take on things. But again, I'll do my absolute best.
I think it's actually better that you are such a hardcore Bard's Tale fan, because that's who I would want to hear a review from.
So, cute things to start out with. References to the
before you go into it.
Okay, holding.
Should probably go through what we're actually going to talk about here officially.
Oh, see, we're already off the rails. I jumped the gun.
I didn't do the spiel yet.
Do the spiel. Do it.
I'll do the spiel. Just let me
do the spiel.
Fucking do the.
Hey, Joe. Huh? Do the spiel.
First game to talk about tonight is called The Bard's Tale 4, developed and published by In Exile Entertainment, released September 18th on Steam for $34.99. The Bard's Tale 4, Barrows Deep, is the triumphant return of one of the most iconic RPG series of all time. Delve into a tactically rich combat system that rewards creativity, solve puzzles to gain treasure and advantages, and discover a beautifully crafted world. George, resume your spiel.
Spiel! That was a beautiful spiel, Joe. That was fantastic.
That's what I do. That's my purpose on this show.
Have you ever considered a career in spiel reading?
I wish. Get me. You're the voice actor. Get me hired somewhere.
I thought you were about to say get me high. I'm like, well, you're far away.
That was last episode.
This is 421. This is the hangover episode.
This is the day after.
It's the worst, and you're not even hungry anymore. Okay, so Bard's Tale 4, spent a bunch of time in it. You know what? Fuck it. Let's go straight to the ugly. To the ugly. Crashes, 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 fucking crashes. Crashes after combat. Crashes after conversation. Crashes after walking for long periods of time. And back to the desktop we go. And back to the last save point, which was a really long time ago. They have employed a system of save tokens which are scattered relatively far in between each other. So that really ticked me off. The only other item on my ugly list... By the way, for those of you who are new to me, I have a good, a bad, and ugly for almost all the games that I review for Joe. The only other item on my ugly list was that, and I'm not sure exactly how to describe this, but all of the combat is basically pre-planned and there for you. Unlike the original trilogy, as far as I could tell, there are no random encounters. Everything has been preordained for you. It's like playing a Lunar game where when you walk into a dungeon, all of your encounters have been set out for you and they're already there and you know what to expect. The game guides you from point A to point B with a little bit of side questing and exploration involved, but the notion of the possibility of an open world, which, if I recall correctly, was something that was bantered about in the Kickstarter plans, is pretty much not there at all. It feels a bit like a bait and switch, especially when one of the taglines in the Kickstarter is "Explore Scarabray like never before." Well, you can, kinda. It's a ruin of the underground version of Scarabray. So I feel like we've already been to the ruins of Scarabray because we did that in The Bard's Tale 3, which, if I recall correctly, most of the original creators were not involved in. So how much of that you want to call canon is up to you. Now, That ends my massive rant of ugly things. My bad list is long, so let's get right into it.
So you're going to save the good for the end.
I'm going to save the good for the end because I want to end on a good note, and I really want to end on a good note, and there's a reason for it. All right. So we're going to downgrade back to the bad. The frame rate drops were really irritating and prevalent and everywhere. And sometimes in places where it didn't seem like there was an awful lot happening graphically, and that interrupted the flow of the immersion of the game quite regularly and quite a bit. So I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but very beginning of the game, when you've seen something happening and you take over, the first instant you try to move and look at something, it chunks along and then eventually it catches up. And then frame rate drops and chunking just happen sporadically. Adjusting my graphic settings did not seem to do much to mitigate that. Simplifications in the stat system, I think, took away a bit from the flavor of the original trilogy. Instead of having all of the usual Dungeons and Dragons stats, strength, intelligence, wisdom, endurance, or constitution, luck... I forgot dexterity before, and dexterity should have been there before. it narrows everything down basically to four stats, and in order to improve any of those stats, it's all tied to gear. Is that a bad thing? I don't know. It didn't feel like what I was expecting, so it it kind of felt a little bit weird. Character customization was a huge and varied part of the original trilogy. I didn't go back to count exactly how many character races there were, but I felt like it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 10. And it, like, everything from humans to elves to half elves to dwarves to did I get half elf? I think I got half elf. You had half orcs, which no one had half orcs in their games. That was awesome. And most of that has been stripped down for this particular game. So as the guy that played the old games, coming into this and seeing it simplified down to basically like four races, I get that it probably makes the game more manageable as far as mechanics go, but I didn't like it. So there, I said that. The masteries sort of take care of it a little bit, but it's supposed to be the same world. So where are all the half-orcs? Where are all the crap. Now I'm forgetting what the rest of the races were. But I think hobbits might have even been a part of the original trilogy for all I can remember. But it's a little bit inconsistent, and I'm sure that was noticeable to diehard fans like me. Inaccuracies in the gauging of enemies by their aura. Every enemy had an aura, like red, green, yellow, orange. It was basically to tell you whether the combat was going to be easy, moderately difficult, or you are proper fucked. And the things that characters will say about them also are represented by the aura that they see. The things that the characters said didn't always match what the aura said. Like, for example, if the aura is red, that's basically do not touch. And the character's saying, it's going to be hard, but I think we can do it. No, don't do it, because it's red and you're at red. Get is proper
shit wrecked.
Pretty much red is party wipe for and not like with toilet tissues and like a group poop. No, it's total death.
Maybe your character was just optimistic.
I realized like the fourth time I said party wipe that could be taken the wrong way. And then I just had to run with it.
Now
I can see why it was necessary now versus the old days where you walked into a battle with 99 whites and got plowed, party wiped. However that may be, the system inaccuracies there kind of led to some really comical results. And by results, I mean death and relocation to the previous save point. And I've already touched on the idea of the save points in this game. The system of save tokens is kind of archaic. They are too few and far between. And death means going back awfully far in some cases, and that stings. It doesn't
and
sting
crashes,
as
you
right,
said before.
And crashes will totally mess that up too. Now, to be fair, it doesn't sting quite as much as your party has been wiped out. Start over. But which it did in the old days, and that did sting, but we're not in the old days anymore, so I can pretend like we've modernized or something. When I get back to the good parts, I'm going to talk about how gorgeous the environments were, and it's worth mentioning during the bad so that I can say that the environments were gorgeous twice. Actually, it'll be thrice by the time we get there. But the characters looked really dated, for lack of a better word. Like they were designed using tools that would have given you characters that looked like they were from the beta version of Oblivion. They looked kind of ugly. In contrast to the environments that were there, the voices, we'll get back to the voices out of the characters were absolutely great. And that's worth mentioning again. But the look was really off. Occasional geometry bugs also made them look almost comical and hideous all at the same time. And like not in that good way, the kind of way that might give my daughter nightmares. For all of the games that I've reviewed for you, Joe, take a stab at what you think my favorite critique is.
What do you mean your favorite critique?
One of the things that I hate the most.
Oh, God.
You're going to know it as soon as I say it, but take a stab
probably
at it.
Probably. I'm lost.
Okay.
Dude, we do so many games on this show with so many positives and negatives that they're all a blur. That like anything. I'm going to forget this in like 20 minutes.
You're probably right. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to back away and say it loudly so everybody can hear me. Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Are we good?
Yes.
Load time! times! Load times! Yeah. They forgot to build the Commodore 64 fast load cartridge into the mechanics of this game.
Jeez.
It took... I tried to clock it, and I got frustrated and went to look for something to drink after about a minute and a half of waiting to get out of the tavern and into the streets. Like, I was so close to dumping that into my ugly category. It was that frustrating. Just load times on modern machines with 1.5 to 2 minutes for load times just broke me.
Did you want to stand back and scream again?
No, because that'll hurt in the morning if I do it again. Inventory management. By the way, this is the last item on my bad list. Inventory management doesn't exist. There are no middle managers here. They've gone full ham on just workers and not. The metaphor is not working. There is no inventory management. There is an inventory, which is good. You can hold stuff. You cannot sort or filter or really rearrange in any kind of functional way. It's like trying to find a USB mini, not micro, mini cable in my colossal mess of a garage. I know it's there. I really need it. And I'm never going to find it, so I just give up and go do something else.
It was buy a new one?
Pretty much. That's what Prime Now is for. That item also almost made it into my ugly list, too, because I was so ticked off. I was almost as ticked off about this as I was about load times. Freaking load times. I mean, seriously. Okay. I got all that out of my system.
Should we discuss the good?
I think we should discuss the good, because there is some good.
So let me hear. What did you enjoy about The Bard's Tale 4?
Okay, so loading up the game, loading screen, seeing a guy not actually playing an instrument, but kind of talking and singing along. Okay, that was cool. Like an actual live actor singing a song about the thing. That was cool. You get into the game, and very quickly, you've gotten a short history of the entire world. And it was thorough, and it definitely felt like a Bard's Tale story based on all of the lore involved. The turn-based combat and style and the grid actually worked fairly well. I saw that criticized pretty heftily, and yeah, the computer AI was sometimes just stupid beyond recognition, but by and large, it actually worked, and it made for a good combat mechanic. It made you think about what you were going to do, and I liked that. The ability trees were extremely interesting to look through, discover, and build upon. That was also fairly heavily criticized, and I didn't get the criticism as much. I did get it when people were frustrated that you gain levels, you get a few points to spend in the ability tree, and all you get for it are stat boosts, and you don't get new abilities. Okay, yeah, that's frustrating at times. But by and large, the ability tree was a really fun added mechanic to this modernization effort. Bards gain power by drinking booze. Let me say that again and reiterate why the bard has always been my favorite character whenever playing Dungeons and Dragons or anything for that matter. Bards gain power by drinking booze. This game is doing it right on that front alone. Just the whole idea. Okay, nerd time. In all of the original Bard's Tale games, the description of the bard always included the phrase, when the going gets tough, the bard goes drinking. Like, without fail. I was a kid, and I didn't actually understand what that meant, but I still got the idea that it was funny. Like, when I would go into the bars in the Bard's Tale 1, I'm like 11 or 10 years old. No clue what I'm doing. And it gives you a list of beverages to choose from, because in the original trilogy, the bard had to recharge his or her voice by drinking something. Otherwise, her voice goes dry and they can't sing any more songs. And the songs were integral to the game back then. And of all the things that were on the menu, the only things I really recognized were wine or ginger ale, because ginger ale was an option. I didn't really know what ale was. I didn't know what mead was. So I always went with ginger ale because I was that guy. And actually, it took me a while to get into the sewers, the cellars of the first game, because it never occurred to me, oh, I should ask for the thing that doesn't match all the other bars in the... Anyway, that's another story for another time. So yeah, bards gain power by drinking booze. This is why...
It works. It fits.
I mean, this is probably why the mini bosses were so successful. Except that was Sparks, I think. Okay. The kind of apocalyptic feel of being on the run in the
Before you move on to that, I do have to give a quick thanks to Swizzlers in the Twitch chat for dropping a couple bits in there. I always give people shout outs when they drop bits for us.
Oh, hell yeah. What bits did you get?
39 bits.
39 bits.
Yep.
Damn, that's a lot of bits.
I'm excited. Makes me happy.
Hey, Joe.
Huh?
What's a bit?
It translates to money. So basically, he's paying me for my services of putting on awful entertainment.
Dude, you are, sir, you are a beautiful person for those bits. Thank you.
See, that's why I give shout outs when people drop bits during a stream that I do, because they don't have to do that. That is their generosity, just being like, hey, I appreciate you. So I appreciate you as well, Swizzlers.
Oh, dropping bits. Oh, God.
Oh, God. God damn. I don't know if anyone's going to get that. But anyway, the apocalyptic feel you were saying?
Yeah, the apocalyptic feel of being on the run is very effectively conveyed from the beginning of the game. It's great. They did a fabulous job of that. The voice acting. Wow. The voice acting is plentiful, varied, and massive. There's so much of it. And I compare this to something like, I'm going back to Oblivion again, but like, do you remember how there were basically like three or four voice actors that did all the voices for all of the characters and NPCs that you ran into in the game, right?
Yeah.
There are so many voice actors in this game, and they're all fun to listen to. They absolutely nailed that part of it, and I was so happy. The music is gorgeous. That's actually, from what I can tell, the most universal recognition that the game has gotten. The music is fabulous. In addition to the fact that the style of it is basically a clinic on Gaelic music. There are so many little snippets and throwbacks and allusions to the original trilogy music in so many different forms. So the nostalgia glasses get all fogged up whenever that happens. The music in the original trilogy was absolutely an integral part of the game mechanics. And here it feels like it's more than just an integral part of the game mechanics. It felt like it was part of the world. And it really showed. Like, if you walk by an NPC, you may not necessarily be able to talk to her, but she'll just be singing a song because she's depressed and trying to cheer herself and the people around her up. And as you walk closer to her, the volume gets louder. As you walk away, her singing gets quieter, but she's very much singing a song, and it's awesome. The environment feels exactly like it should feel everywhere you are at. Crowds of people actually sound like crowds of people, and cool stuff like in the underground Scarabray area, walking by a building and hearing hushed voices as you get closer. It you can't tell where they're coming from exactly, but you know that they're coming from this house that you can't get into. It's really engrossing, and it very much adds to the whole kind of you're on the run feel, and people are hiding and people are scared, and it really adds to that. It reminds me of something that Richard Garriott tried to do when Ultima 9 came out in the, I think it was the mid-90s, where you went into
the day.
Back in the day, my day, we didn't have any grass. We had to smoke the dirt. Yeah. Yeah, back in the day, in when he was revolutionizing everything that we take for granted now, I remember there was a scene in the museum where you walk in and there aren't any other NPCs, but they piped in crowd noise to make it sound like there were lots of people in the museum. Hey, it was hokey, but no one else was doing it. And it was a gamble. And the 3D behind the character view obviously paid off because it paved the way for every other game that did that. But yeah, the Bard's Tale 4 definitely takes that concept and absolutely successfully enacts it in a way that makes you feel completely and totally immersed in a way that is not hokey. It really, really worked. Nice. The puzzles were fun and engaging. They made you think, and I was absolutely on board with that. Puzzles and riddles and stuff were definitely a part of the original trilogy. So it was cool that they found a way to add puzzle type things to this particular game. Okay, that's the end of my good list. We've already gone over.
You want to know one more good thing?
Hit me.
Not only did Swizzlers drop another 200 bits, but he just subscribed to us on Twitch for the second month in a row.
Shut up.
So that is not only good, that is fucking awesome. So thank you so much, Swizzlers.
Dropping bits all over your face again.
Part of me, like, I don't like having sound effects on my streams just because the show will pick up that audio.
Yeah. And
I am so tempted to just have you do that for any time I get bits. He said, no need to shout out, though. I got to drop more bits just to hear you.
Yeah!
Oh,
we're winning!
Oh, okay. My Lord. I need to have you on the show so much more.
I know. Okay.
So I'm gonna what else? The good, the bad, the ugly. What else is there?
Here, I'm going to come. Let's just bottom line the entire affair.
Let's hear it. For 35 bucks on this one.
Whoa. I'm not ready for that.
Oh, well, you said bottom line. I thought you were ready for the verdict.
I'm going to wrap this whole thing up in a nice little bow. There is more to life than try it, buy it, or fuck it, Joe.
No.
Oh. Well, there is for the moment.
Okay, so let's hear it. What's your bottom line?
My take, because if I say bottom line, you're going to make me decide. The game, as far as I can tell, feels half-baked. Maybe quarter-baked. I don't know. The bugs were really plentiful and irritating. The multiple crashes, as far as I'm concerned, were absolutely unforgivable. And the overall feel kind of left me wanting something more polished. I'm absolutely convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that in like 3 or 6 months from now, the patches that will continuously come out, and I know that they're working feverishly on patches and updates, the game is going to be way better than what we're playing right now. Absolutely. I really truly believe that. It currently feels like it was rushed to release, and it just needs more time in the bug fixing chamber and a few more sacrificed crash test dummies, and it'll be ready to go. It's not there yet, but I do believe it's going to get there.
I mean, I guess that's one of the good things with games these days is they could release with issues, but they get patched so frequently that in due time, it could be a much better, much different game.
See, I totally agree, and it still pisses me off because I come from an era where games did not release with bugs, or if they did, they were permanent because there was no going back and patching it. So
it's a whole new world, man. A whole new world. Sorry. Deserved it.
Yeah, you earned that one. So now we're on the verdict. We're on the verdict. Here it is. Ask me the question. Ask me the fucking question.
All right, George, I got to know the good, the bad, the ugly, the bottom line, mm-hmm. 35 bucks on this. What do you think of it?
Try it. If the bugs tick you off now, come back in 6 months and try it again. because I am willing to almost bet money or bits that it's going to be a way better gaming experience. I really, truly believe that.
Do you want to come back in 6 months and let us know?
You know, why don't let's look at our calendars and see what's going on. Let's see. Google Calendar. What's 6 months from now? That's April.
What's your April look like?
Let's see. April. That's March. We don't need to look in March. April. Well,
hey, my birthday's in March. March is good.
just suck it. Let's see. I don't remember when Orthodox Easter is next year. It could be the same. It could be different. I don't know. But we can certainly pencil something in. You call my administrative assistant and we'll get something set up and everything will be fantastic.
All right. So sometime in April, we're going to get you back on and get your second thoughts on Bard's Tale 4.
Yeah. In fact, I'm actually going to make sure that I set myself a reminder for beginning of March to start really diving into it again.
Nice.
Here we go. New event. We're going to call it an all-day event. Start Bards, not Bars. Although that's pretty funny. Tail, not take, tail. Swipe, you fail. Start Bard's Tale 4 again with patches. Now, that's not to say that I'm not going to keep playing it, because I'm probably going to keep playing it. But if for some reason I've fallen off the bandwagon by then, that'll be a reminder to come back to it.
Nice.
There you have it.
So it sounds like if they take care of the technical issues, this could be a winner.
Absolutely. Nice. Definitely. No doubt about it. I have full faith in their capability to turn the ship around and make something absolutely fantastic out of it. I think they've got all of the components there. Obviously, it's not the dungeon crawler that we all grew up with, but it's its own new thing, and it builds on the lore of the original game. And it's like 30 years later or something, so they're allowed to do different things with the available technology and try to make something new and exciting. When they built the original Bard's Tale game, it built on a familiar formula of first person 3D view, but they did it in a way that was gorgeous, because what you had back then was you had wizardry, where your town was just a bunch of text, and then when you went into the proving grounds of the Mad Overlord, it was black and white, three-dimensional, but it was black and white, turn-based movement walls. And you'd occasionally see a monster when you went into combat, but that was it. That mechanic survived for a long time. The black and white walls, you had that in Wizardry, you had that in Ultima, you had it in a variety of other games. But the Bard's Tale made it pretty. You had environments, you had skins, you had sewers where the walls dripped slime. You had Mangar's castle, where there were faces in the walls, and they looked at you, and their eyes glowed. Like, they really upped the ante on gaming of the era. And I think they've got it here, too. They just need to make the thing run more consistently for everybody, which I recognize is not easy, because different PC requirements are all different for everybody. And having said that, that's been kind of the universal criticism, is that it just crashes way too much and the frame rates drop and it just needs more time in the oven.
Well, in a couple of months, we will definitely revisit this, and I'm looking forward to that. George, it is always a pleasure having you on. I think this is officially the longest review we've ever done on the show. So,
oh man.
Congrats.
How long have we been at the record? Thank you.
Since we came back from break, it's been 42 minutes.
Oh crap.
Yeah.
So, I blame all those bits.
Yes, that's clearly the only reason why we went long.
Totally.
George, do you have any final thoughts to wrap it up before we move on?
I am a bard, and I think it's time to go drinking.
All right, moving on, we got Pernell Vaughn here. Pernell, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, though I totally just kind of ruined everyone's day over here with the by resurrecting Yami and Laurel.
Because you had to do it on the show as well, didn't you?
I did. Everyone can suffer because I suffer. So when I suffer, you all have to suffer.
Bitch. You son Yami. Of a bitch.
I'm feeling yawny. I'm feeling yammy.
We're not going down this rabbit hole. We're not.
It's a great rabbit hole, though. You got to admit. It's got carrots. It's got cool TV. You can party Buster style down here. Anything goes.
Very true.
I suppose it's true. You're not supposed to agree with me. You're supposed to dismiss it. Then I have to convince you over 10 minutes of very, very well thought out dialogue.
But we got a game to talk about. We can't go down into this rabbit hole when we have a Vidya game that we got to discuss.
That is true. We can go down that rabbit hole instead. Maybe we'll find carrots or some sort of
Buster. Well, you're the one who played it, so you would know if there's carrots in the game or not.
That is true. Spoiler alert, there are no carrots in this
game. Son of a bitch, again. You're just
always with the lack of carrots. Where's our beta carotene?
You're ruining my night, Purnell.
That's what I'm born to do, baby.
I want to go back an episode, back to 420, and just forget all my worries.
Don't worry, I'll make sure to slip Yanny in there too.
Oh no, we already recorded that one. That one's done and buried.
Well,
hopefully
that's the magic
forever.
For now, it will change. It is not the same as you left it. It now has Yanny in it.
I swear to God, if I listened to the episode and I heard Yanny in there, I wouldn't be shocked with how little of that episode I remember.
I'm telling you. See, now you have to, because I want that to be the case. So that I can take the blame for it, and you can never doubt my magic powers again. It's just fact.
Oh, Purnell.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba, you cheeky bastard. Hey.
Anyway, you are here to talk about a game that is called Valtherian Arc Hero School Story, developed by Agate, published by P-Cube Limited, released October 2nd on Switch, PS4, and Steam for $14.99. Physical version is available as well for $19.99. Have you ever wondered where all the powerful knights and wizards come from? No one is born a hero. It is your job as principal of Valtheria Academy to train the most promising students to become heroes of legend. Purnell, what is this game?
It is a sim, but not a bad sim. Just more like, it feels like a busy work sim. But I should explain it before I start throwing words around that are big and not small. So, the idea behind this game is that the headmaster of the school is retiring, and now they are bringing in you, who was apparently a previous graduate from Hero School. I'm not going to say the name of the school because I hate it. I never get it right. You're bringing you in to now manage the school. And what the school management entails is a regular process / routine of admitting new students that walk onto the campus grounds. They don't even pay enrollment tuition. They just show up. So, very unlike a typical school, but they just kind of come along. Free education, right? The player has to pay all the debts. You got to pay for all the buildings to get constructed and whatnot, which I will get into shortly. But students come in and then you assign them to battle parties or party parties, whatever you want to call them. And then you have them fulfill various missions that come through the school. What is the point of fulfilling these missions? Well, to get rewards in the form of experience or scraps, because scraps are a reward in this world, and also just general money. The experience goes towards leveling up your students. Level up your student to level 10. I think you can level them up, do this sooner, but I just did it because it made the most sense. But when you hit level 10, you can promote your students in the event that you have the proper academies constructed or classes constructed, along with the proper mentors to go with them, being like a knight or a mage or a scout. Or you can just graduate them. And the point of graduating a student is, one, because you get monetary benefits and experience-based benefits for your academy. And more so also because you kind of have to. Throughout the game, like twice a year, there's a decree that comes down and says, hey, we need some students. Graduate these bad boys right now or within the 6-month period. And at that point, you have to raise up students and then send them off to the wide world to hopefully not die, a la Valkyrie Profile with sending your soldiers to Ragnarok, or to Valhalla, the battle and the coming of Ragnarok. So you build up students, you send them out to get experience, boost them as high as you can, and then you graduate them for money and points. In addition to this, you can also kind of, there's like a bit of a facility off to the side of the campus where you can, if you manage to find recipes on your endeavors, which I'll also get into shortly, you will be able to construct equipment using scraps and materials to equip on your students to bolster their stats. Only different classes can equip different items, of course, so you kind of have to be careful about that. Like I did, where I promoted a character to a knight, but had no weapons for knights to use. So she was out there. Well, technically she'd be punching, but they give you like a default sword animation, but she had no sword to swing. So whatever. But then later on, a traveling merchant showed up at the school, and I spent 3/4 of my finances on a sword that pretty much has been kicking everyone's butt for the past like 2 ranks. So
nice.
I'm not even complaining. But what happens is now is like what I meant to say. I need to go into this a little bit more, I guess. So what happens when you go on missions is that you'll pull up a map. The map will show you a variety of different things you can do. Each of those things requires to a certain amount of time it takes to get it done. So like if you go on, I don't know, a mission that takes 3 weeks, 3 weeks of the game's clock will cycle. And the time some periods that cycle through the game are weeks, then months, then years. So keep that in mind. There aren't days in this game, just weeks at the minimum. So once you do a mission, that many weeks will go by if the mission is an action mission. In an action mission, you will take a party of up to 4 players or 4 students, and you will send them out into the wild to fulfill one of various tasks. Sometimes it's an arena where you have to beat a bunch of guys up. Sometimes it's a material hunt where you might have to go around and find different items on the map, like, you know, kind of hold the button down over until you collect it and then get enough and you can leave the level. Sometimes it's finding a certain character. Sometimes a combination of those things, killing monsters, finding things, and, you know, just kind of exploring a map. Every map you go to is randomly generated, and it's like a small bit of a hub. So the game randomly assigns a few turns and twists, sometimes ladders to go up to a second floor, and they dump a bunch of monsters on the map to kill for experience and items. And sometimes you'll find, like, say, barrels littered about. You smack a barrel, sometimes the item's in there, you can take that back to the school as well.
Nice.
It's basically that, but then the other type of errand is actually called an errand, as opposed to a mission. And what errands are, someone's asking you to do something, and you can kind of just submit a team of party members off to do the mission without you controlling them. So you'll wait a certain number of weeks, they'll come back, hopefully they'll succeed. Sometimes they don't. But if they do, you'll get the experience point rewards and whatever comes with that mission as well. As you upgrade the school by getting a certain number of experience points for the school, new facilities will open up. Also, you'll be able to upgrade your facilities. What facilities do, aside from what they outright say, like allowing you to upgrade and recruit members and things of that nature, sometimes they will allow you to hold more students at the academy, i.e. a dormitory. Sometimes they'll allow you to get more experience on missions. Sometimes they'll let you get more gold per week because you get like a regular income. But everything, for the most part, has a sub bonus that factors in when you go on mission. So like if you have, like say, I'm just making this up because I don't remember the exacts, but you have 2 classrooms. Each classroom gives you a bonus 4% experience when you go on missions. So now every time you go out, you get 8% experience bonus to everything you do on the mission. So it's kind of a nice little thing to have set up for the school as well. But it's honestly an enjoyable little game. I did feel kind of guilty because I had one super student that I decided, the one I gave that cool sword to, that I really didn't want to graduate. So until I ended up getting more knights up to her level, she just kind of became an eternal student. maybe she's kind of like Ferris Bueller in that way, or Rodney Dangerfield, just never wants to leave school and party all the time. But she just carried all the party members, got all the experience for them, allowed me to bolster them as I needed, and then dipped them out the door. So, and of course the game does get harder, and some of the levels will dump a bunch of guys on you at once where you're like, man, I need more powerful guys. But I was really milking that super powered sword, which I genuinely think the game did not mean for you to buy when they offered it to me. Because like I said, it broke my wallet, and the attack power was well beyond anything else I had available or accessible to me. So it was almost like, hey, he won't buy. He did. Oh crap. This was not.
So you were just wrecking shit.
I pretty much was. I had the super knight just leading all the other students to victory. It was the equivalent of cheating on an exam, which for the record, I did do a level where it was an exam or two. And it was like, hey, go out there and pass this exam. We're counting on you. Do these things. I'm like, yeah, I got the super student. Start whacking everything. And all the other kids were just following behind. Like, yay, we're going to pass. It was the ultimate equivalent of like SAT cheating. Just follow the smart kid or follow the brawny kid. We'll just pass through her. And they did.
That is fantastic.
Indeed. It was a good time. and it's still a good time. It's, I will say, though, that I got to openly say that gameplay-wise, this is definitely like a sort of like a sim loop, as in do a thing, get the money, build the school to submit to graduate students, and keep progressing. And as you do that, of course, it's like a little side story of, like, you know, these different kingdoms trying to bolster your favor because the queen died and they want to take over the position. And for some reason, your academy has the means to make the new queen the world queen. Who the frig knows? But they want to smooze you. So that usually involves going on missions for them. And that's like a little side plot that's going to take place throughout there. But your ultimate goal is just to build this school up and get some nice numbers. But the combat is very light. Like, you're not going to go out there and, like, you can get, like, different, you know, abilities to upgrade them to, but it's nothing complicated. It might be at level 5, you can choose to give them additional attack hit points or defense, and they get, like, one ability that goes for, like, the power whack, and there's one really super ability that they can get once you get into, like, the third class. But for the most part, it's very simple combat. It's not bad combat, it's simple. So if you're coming into this expecting complication, do not look for that. You're coming into this to get into that cool sim hamster wheel. Also, you can, good, I mean, like I said, unless you pull the Rodney Dangerfield like I'm doing, you're not really going to get attached to any of the students, because the students come and go. You're pretty much graduating these cats like a hamster wheel. Get in my school and get out of my school. I want to get paid. So, you know, you'll get a kid that comes and is like, how do you do? Or they have they all have the same wording, but there's like multiple voices that do it, like, to your, I don't know what the hell the word is. I can't remember the statement, but it's like, as you wish.
As you wish.
As you wish.
But they all say as you wish, basically.
Do more voices. Do more voices.
As you wish.
Yeah, as you wish.
As you wish.
As you wish.
It just goes. Lots of as you wishing taking place. Everyone's
hey,
as
simple you things wish for simple minds. What can I say?
Hear, hear to that, man. But I will say I enjoyed playing the game, though. It is one of those games where I won't say jump ahead of the trough to get to it, mind you. But if you are looking for some, well, I should wait. I always do that. I guess while I go beelining into it.
You're just so excited to tell people.
I am. But did you have any inquiries about it that I may not have touched on by chance?
No, it sounds really cool. It sounds, if someone's looking for an action RPG, it doesn't really seem like it'll scratch that itch. But if someone's looking for a unique take on sim games with some action RPG elements, this might scratch that itch.
I would go with that. Yes, this is definitely that kind of game. So it's definitely on the try it with the step towards buy it, because it's cheap enough to give a shot to. And I feel like by the time you get tired of it, if you do, you will have easily made your money off of it. But the goal is that you don't go on looking for an action RPG. Go on looking for a sim with those action RPG elements. And I think you'll be pleased by it.
Awesome.
Especially with the price point they give it.
Yeah, only $15.
What? Yeah. I think it was worth it. I was actually looking to buy this game anyway, so I was like, yeah, I'm enjoying this game. I would have paid money for this. I would have bought this.
Well, buy it for me instead.
I don't know about that now. You got it.
You son Christmas of a bitch.
Christmas time's coming, which for that means is I got to buy things for myself. But I'll think about it. We'll talk about it. Maybe if you're interested in that. But it's a good game, though. I think you'd probably like it, too, if you wanted to give it a crack.
Yeah, sounds pretty awesome. So I might have to jump on this one myself.
Jump on it, Tonto. That's not how it goes. Yeah. But
Purnell, you never fail to make me laugh when you're on.
That's what I like to do. In that case, mission accomplished.
Indeed. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap it up?
Actually, I kind of do for once.
Oh, so, really?
Yes, indeed. So I might have to give you the link for later, but as of today, I stopped being lazy and I set up an Extra Life campaign for Rhythm and Pixels. It's just to say, like, I mentioned on the episode once and someone was like, yeah, we would totally support them. I'm like, no, you wouldn't. But now someone said it, I got to try. So I threw up an Extra Life campaign. If anybody's interested, please donate. It's just Rhythm and Pixels on extralife.org. I don't know. I'm going to play a bunch of games or some crap. You know how it goes. But the important part is the money goes to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Wanted to do AI DuPont, but they are not on the Miracle Children's Network. So hung the D. Never know. It'd be nice. Money goes to a good cause. I can suffer for 24 hours. It's win-win.
Very true. So we'll have that link in the show notes. I'll be sure to toss it down there. So if people want to check it out, they could check out all the fun links that we have in the show notes and find it and go support you.
Sweet diggums.
All right, moving on. We got Chris Taylor here. How are you doing, Chris?
Hey, doing great.
How was your weekend?
Oh, pretty good. Playing that Skyrim.
Still? You're still balls deep in Skyrim, huh?
Yeah, well, I did the Dragonborn DLC for the first time, and that was pretty fun.
Do you play anything besides Skyrim?
Actually, yes. I played three games besides Skyrim, if you must know.
Oh, gee, did you?
Yeah. No, I also played some Dragon Quest XI, and actually restarted Super Mario Odyssey recently.
Nice.
And I'm like, oh, how many things do I have in there? I'm like in the fourth world now, so that's going along too.
You were playing a solid lineup of games.
Yeah. It's just mostly Skyrim. I'm trying to get that one more playthrough where I get all the good stuff, and then I'll be ready to put it down for a while.
No, you won't.
No. Well, a while for me apparently is like a week or less. So,
which, yeah, that's this about is how why long I, you could put Skyrim down for.
This is why I skipped Oblivion, because I did the same thing with Morrowind, and I did the same thing with Daggerfall. I'm just too into sandbox RPGs.
See, that just means you got to go back and play Oblivion now.
Yeah, I know. I've got it.
Well, there you go. You're all set.
Yeah, just got to get me a better Xbox 360 controller. So that's the system I have it on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we talk games?
Yeah, let's talk about other video games.
Cool, because you do have three to talk about. We're going to start things off with Vertical Drop Heroes HD, developed by Nerduke Productions and Stage Clear Studios, published by Digirati, released October 4th on the Switch for $9.99. Vertical Drop Heroes is a procedural platformer RPG hybrid with roguelike elements, where your hero adventures through randomly generated stages. Armed with a variety of skills and traits, you must use your cunning and reflexes to survive the dangers of each stage until you face the final boss and uncover the truth behind the game. Chris, what did you think of Vertical Drop Heroes HD?
I think that's slightly inaccurate. It makes it sound like you can just go through levels when you play this game. This is a game, and this is sort of implicit in the introduction to the game, is that this is a game that's won by throwing countless doomed heroes at the game so that they die, but their progress is somewhat, you know, held over for the next hero. So it's like, this is a story about one hero who saves the day and the countless others who don't. So this is it is a little bit of a roguelite. I guess that's the more merciful version of roguelike, but it is on the whole like an entirely different thing, so I'm going to describe it as best I can. So you select one of three heroes, and so the heroes, the difference between them, they all are given random names, and they're usually pretty funny hero style names. And then like they have like just this kind of the graphics for them is just this kind of random mishmash of like different you know, aspects. So you never know what your hero is really going to look like. They all look vaguely hero-like. they're given a weapon. The weapons I've noticed have been like short-range weapons, sometimes dual-wielding, sometimes stronger weapons that have a speed penalty, and then sometimes projectile weapons that only have limited shots, and then it turns into a short-range weapon. And those actually are really good. But and then, you know, at first they're not given any bonuses, but so here's what happens. You select one of these heroes, whichever one looks best for you. You start off in a room where you are able to purchase upgrades, and there's three different kinds of upgrades. One for your weapon, one for your starting HP, and one for your pacifism points, which is an interesting aspect. So you then jump into the game, and it literally drops you into a basically the top of a level that you then proceed downwards and fight enemies along the way. Or if you choose not to fight the enemies, then you collect pacifist orbs, which adds to your experience and gold. And the first time you kill an enemy, they all disappear. And then you basically, you'll be completing the level violently. So that was a really interesting one to me as a roguelike that has pacifist mode. It was bewildering and yet worked really well because you can upgrade those spheres as you go along. So you can actually work your way towards being a pretty good pacifist because you can even skip the bosses if you have enough keys and you find the keys throughout the levels. So, and there's actually, so the other thing about it is that occasionally you'll come across shopkeepers within the levels who will offer to sell you upgrades, including an upgrade that. And so the upgrades, they go onto your character currently if they state they will. But more importantly, they become an option for every future character that you inevitably will select from. Because as soon as your character dies, you then go back to the character selection screen and choose one of the three characters. And of course, there'll be different characters now, except there will always be one character who is exactly the character that just died, only with a 1 or a 2 or a 3 at the end of their name, you know? So on and so forth. So you can always keep playing as the same character until you choose someone else, and then that character's gone. Which, again, I find that really pretty brilliant, actually. Because I like that idea of continuing if you were really into the character that you were playing as. But yeah, so any gold that you collect in the game always stays with you. And, you know, when you start your new character off and you start off in that first section, then you can go and buy your upgrades. And those upgrades will apply to every future character. So essentially what you're doing is every time you go through these levels, you know, maybe halfway through the first level before you die the first time, every single time you end up with all this stuff that your second character and, you know, is going to improve on for every future character and third character and fourth character. And, you know, 20 characters later, finally you're like able to clear the first level really easily and you get into the second, third level, fourth level, you know, and it just keeps scaling up. So this ends up being a really addicting, like, roguelike. Like, I think that this guy stumbled upon, I want to say the perfect formula for combining, you know, the randomness of the adventure with a sense of progress. And I say guy because this apparently was developed by one person.
I am so happy to hear that you enjoyed this game.
Yeah.
Because
No. This game is fantastic.
Like on Xbox One, I put over 24 hours into this game.
Yeah, I actually ended up playing this more than Skyrim this weekend, I think. But don't quote me on that.
Too late, already quoted.
It's on. Ah, damn it. No, yeah, it's true. It is on public record now.
I'll go back and censor it.
But yeah, so you know as well as I do, like it's damn, they got this formula right.
Yeah, they fucking nailed it with this game.
Yeah, it is, and it's spectacular on the Switch. Works really well in portable mode. It has a split-screen two-player option that I wasn't able to explore, but it looked really cool, and I would love to play this with somebody else that's into this kind of thing. And of course, you can unlock computer AI partners, which is one of the fun parts of this thing. You know, a thief that drops, like, a trail of coins for you to collect, or a you know, a knight that basically busts through, like, the whole level. Like, they literally break parts of the level while they're going after enemies. Or a wizard that does all kinds of mischief. Like, there's so many things within these levels that randomly pop up. Like, there's all kinds of little side quests. Finding a king's royal puppies. or flowers or a diamond for a princess. And, like, all of it equals like tangible rewards that will apply to either your character currently or the next character. So, wow. I was really impressed by Vertical Drop Heroes HD.
Well, then for $10, what do you think of it?
It could be 3 times that and I would still buy it. But at $10, yes, this is a steal. If you you know, if you're having trouble selecting from the seemingly endless ocean of roguelike adventures that are available in the Switch's eShop, I put this one right up, if not over, Quest of Dungeons, which has been my favorite so far. So definitely get this one.
We think alike with our appreciation of those two games.
Yeah, Quest of Dungeons is no slouch. That is a great game too. In fact, I beat it recently, like I think last week again.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good one to just pop in.
Well, from dungeon diving to ball whacking, the next game to talk about is called Boom Ball Boost Edition, developed and published by our friends at Virtual Air Guitar Company, released October 11th on the Switch for $12.99, so it will be out tomorrow by the time you hear this. Pick up your boom ball and smash all the blocks. Chris, what is Boom Ball Boost Edition?
I like when the synopsis is just one sentence. Also, I love the name Virtual Air Guitar. They're an awesome company.
They focused a lot on Kinect games on the Xbox One, but because of the pretty much the death of Kinect, it looks like they're branching out, and I'm excited to hear how the Switch version of Boom Ball is.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the Kinect seemed like it was kind of a response to the Wii, which was, you know, Nintendo's, like, you know, game-changing sort of immersive controller waggle that they decided to expand further into a more, like, sort of VR experience, but not quite. And then, I guess, AR, you would say. But it's interesting now that since the Kinect is no more, that they brought it back around to a Nintendo system with controller waggle. So, yeah. Basically, yeah, playing this game, I really felt like I was back in 2006, like, you know, playing Wii Tennis or whatever for the first time. Like, you know, it's hardly ever that I play games that interface directly with the controller, with the motion controls and the actual game exclusively. So this one was really refreshing to me. So what I like, basically, here's the gist of it. Like, and speaking of Wii, it seems to have elements of Boom Blocks, if you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of a Jenga game where you knock over, like, towers and stuff by throwing balls at it. Specifically that, you start off with your two controllers, and your two controllers control two paddles that are transparently on the screen, and they follow your every movement. You basically grab a ball from the air, and you fling it at the target. And the target is just a thing made of blocks that is moving. And then you essentially play a game of Arkanoid from the 3D plane. So the ball keeps bouncing back to you, and you have to keep the ball in play, wrecking these 3D pixel creations. And, you know, the level's clear as soon as you destroy all the pixels. Which, interestingly, I haven't actually seen that a lot. Like, mixing the Arkanoid, break-em-all kind of formula with, that basic thing with, you know, the motion controls and the first person-ness. So what I really like about this one is, like those games, they have all kinds of ways that you can sort of power up your ball or add extra challenge or speed things up, slow things down. So what I really like on that one is that sometimes you'll get a power-up which will multiply your ball into a multi-ball situation, and then you're batting off, like, you know, 4, 5, 10, they say up to 24 balls.
Jesus.
Yeah. And so you're just sitting there like, bah, 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 bah. You know, and you only have to block the balls. You don't actually have to hit them, but depending on where you hit them, it will change their trajectory. And it's very, very, like, realistic volleyball-like physics. In fact, it has a sound effect that, to me, reminded me perfectly of actually hitting a sports ball of some kind. You know, basketball or volleyball, dodgeball, take your pick. Actually, probably reminded me the most of dodgeball. But anyways, so there's a couple of things that I really like that this game does. One of them is that, and this has always been that the biggest hang-up for me and the paddleball, like, you know, bust-all-the-bricks type games. So you know, you're doing just what you're doing just fine on the puzzle, but then you get down to like three blocks and you're just sitting there and the ball is hitting the paddle and you're just trying to get it over to those last three.
Yeah.
So it's like you spend 5 minutes having all this fun and then you spend like 20 minutes sitting there like watching the thing and being like, please move slightly more to the left. This game eliminates that because as soon as you get down to a certain amount of blocks, the game automatically changes the gameplay ball into fireballs that you then just kind of bat in the general direction of the remaining pixels and it just burns them up and you're done. So if you get close enough, the game basically is like, all right, that's good. You earned it.
Which so you don't I love.
Yes, it's excellent. It's excellent the way they did that. The other thing that I really enjoy is that the actual gameplay models themselves are a delight. They're adorable. Like, they make animals out of them. There's a tractor that you defeat, like sheep and dogs and things like that. And the best part is that usually in a slightly hard-to-reach play area, but not always, there's a blinking block, and if you hit that, it explodes the whole thing. So, if you're really good, you can cause these adorable, like, block creatures to explode rather than just take them out a bit at a time. So, that's absolutely what you want to go for, because you get those time bonuses, and the more bonuses, there's four available bonuses per level, and each one unlocks a bonus level, which are a little more elaborate and also, I think, really fun. The first one is a pirate ship, which actually has this like ska song in it that I really, really like. And I'm going to try and see if I can find it to download. The soundtrack is really, really good in this game. So, which, by the way, I didn't mention, the last game also has a great soundtrack. I was really impressed with that. Anyways, so yeah, this is it. Seems like it's overly simple in concept, but once you dive in, like, this game is really well put together, and it's extremely fun. And you can always, like, it's got basically instant two-player, because just hand the controller, the left controller or whatever, over to another person, and you're playing two-player.
Which I imagine works a lot better than two people trying to stand next to each other in the Kinect version, because my wife and I used to play it together. And we would just bump into each other and smack each other. And I can only imagine how much easier it is with a Joy-Con instead of full body contact.
Yeah, no. You just it's controller waggle. You'll be fine with this one. Oh, and by the way, and you know, you specially asked me to do this, I tried it in touchscreen mode, which is something introduced in on the Switch exclusively. It's really good. In fact, I say it's possibly even better.
Wow.
Instead of controlling the paddles, you just touch the screen, and they completely alter the look of the gameplay to accommodate looking at the touchscreen. And so basically, when the ball is coming at you, rather than having your paddle in the way, when the ball gets to a certain depth, it will flash green, and that means you can touch it. And then whatever direction your finger slides across the screen, and it could be just like the lightest feather touch, so you don't actually have to beat up your screen or anything. Whatever direction your finger's moving in is going to be the direction that it bats in, and it's really intuitive and quite good. So this is a game that works really well in portable mode.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, overall, $13 on it. What do you think of it?
Yeah, it's a winner. This one you definitely want to keep around, if for nothing else than just a casual throwdown. But I mean, if you're like me, then you're gonna quickly get through 22 levels and a couple of the bonus levels too in one sit down. So nice. That was my initial experience with this one.
Nice. So get it. You're 2 for 2 so far.
Oh yeah.
Are we gonna make it 3 for 3?
I'm predicting probably.
All right, well, let's talk about it, because the last game that you're here to talk about is called Salaryman Escape, developed by Red Accent Studios, published by Oasis Games, released September 18th on PS4 and PSVR for $15.99, Steam and Steam VR for $10.99. Tired of work, feeling trapped at your position with no hope of promotion? Vent out your frustrations with Salaryman Escape, a satirical and edgy physics puzzle game about helping a disgruntled salaryman escape his miserable life. Chris, what is this game?
I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. It really is one of those kind of games that's like kind of bizarre and surreal. And it definitely taps into, so it is a satire of the salaried businessman, but I wonder, you know, there's a little bit of a Bill Lumberg, like Office Space sort of vibe to it sometimes.
Yeah.
I love that. But like, it also seems very Japanese, from what I know of Japanese media when they talk about business and, you know, especially in a satirical way, it really seems to fall in line with that. But either way, we all know the story. Like, you know, you get into a middleman, you know, cubicle wearing a suit type of thing. And, you know, it just seems like your whole life is built around this whole corporate structure and such. And of course you want to escape. So the abstract way that we escape in this is through a, sort of, so it's a physics, based puzzle that incorporates elements of, I actually want to say Jenga, but you know, could be other things. So the way it goes is that you have this stage that is, you know, it's just made of your basic, you know, smoothed over polygons. You got your guy sitting here. He's just standing there. There's obstacles in his way. White blocks are immovable, but red blocks can be moved. And so you rotate, the stage every which way and use the motion control, feature of the DualShock or, you know, your VR controller, which I don't have VR, so I only played this with a DualShock 4. So, you know, you can consider this an incomplete review, I suppose. But, well,
not everyone has the VR, so.
Yeah, exactly.
And the whole point of this current release is that it's available on flat screen instead of requiring VR. It used to be VR required.
Right. So that's just, you know, just calibrating the expectations here is that I did not play this on VR. So you rotate it around, you use your motion control to target one of the, pieces, and then you grab it and then use the stick to kind of pull around on it and stuff like that. It's not the most intuitive control scheme in the world, but I mean, there's only, you know, the time limit goes up, not down. So, or rather the timer goes up, not down. So it's not exactly as if, you can't afford to be imprecise, except that you can knock over things. Basically your goal is to provide a clear path to the exit of the level for your character, who will, as soon as there's a clear path, will automatically start running towards it. Now some levels will contain like, oh, you know, actually I think the timer does go down. Never mind. I'm sorry. So you do have a limited amount of time. I just remembered that because in some of the stages, well, that just lets you know I didn't run out of time very often. In some of the stages, there'll be like a cup of coffee. And if you can race to that cup of coffee, then that buys you some time. And then you get to, you know, mess around a little bit more with it. And also some stages have bonuses like coins that are just kind of, you know, usually in hard to reach places. And so you really have to turn on your brain to figure out how to get to that coin and then to the exit. And, mercifully, the game will actually show you on the stage select screen exactly which stages have coins in them. So you don't have to go looking for something that's not there, in other stages, like in, what was that? Ink, I think. Like Ink wouldn't tell you where or if there were bonus items. You just had to find them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that works too. Anyways, so basically between, you know, the first stages start off really easy. It's tutorial style. And then the difficulty ramps up quite a lot. But it's actually really interesting. And the puzzles that they lay out are, they really require a lot of, like, spatial awareness and sort of, you know, being able to predict what's going to happen when you move this certain way or this that certain way. And some of it does involve a bit of trial and error. And then but you know, ultimately I think it's really fun. And your reward, at the end of each stage is that, it basically will describe some kind of business-like scenario, and you know, in this sort of corporate speak sort of way, like I said, the Bill Lumberg sort of thing. And it's really funny. Like, I love all of them. Like, I really look forward to every stage starting, because they just had these great little, you know, vicious little jabs at corporate life, which is cool for me, because I'm the kind of cool dude that really doesn't go in for that sort of BS. So, yeah, it's, I mean, that it is, that's basically what it is. I mean, I understand that the game introduces enemies at some point, but I got pretty far and didn't see any, so I guess that's more of a middle of the game sort of thing.
Guess so.
Yeah. But,
overall, for $16 on PlayStation, $11 on Steam, what do you think of this?
I think $11 on Steam sounds better. I mean, I'm not sure what the PlayStation version has to recommend it over the Steam thing, other than the PS4 controller, which I think also works on Steam, right?
Console port, I guess.
Console port, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know why the PlayStation tax, but this is a very solid game. It's going to be a little simplistic for some folks. There's not a whole lot in the way of graphics. I really like the soundtrack, but it's not the most, it's a lot of J-pop sort of stuff, a lot of vocal themes. I enjoyed them. And of course the satire is A+. Very good. So it's kind of like, if this seems like the sort of thing that's really interesting to you, certainly it's worth $16 because it is quality and there seems to be a lot of it. And of course, you know, the story seems to go in like this direction that I'm really looking forward to seeing how it concludes. So this does keep you coming back for more, and the puzzles are really challenging and I think really good for, you know, for folks who like to think. But if you're just going in like expecting, you know, the absurdity and the, you know, just straight up action or something like that, then, you know, this might not be your game. It's a puzzle game through and through. It's just decorated in a really absurd way that is appealing to, I don't know who, to me, well, but I can't even tell you why. I'm a fan
of the absurd as well.
Yeah, and I've never been a salary guy. Maybe that's why I like it. This is because it just presents this view of a world I already find absurd.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like three good games out of you this week.
Yeah, three good games. I mean, I really, really like Vertical Drop Heroes, but, you know, all three of these are worth your time for sure.
Awesome. Chris, it is always a pleasure having you on chatting about this stuff. Any final thoughts to wrap it up?
Quit your jobs, everybody.
All right, final game to talk about tonight is called Think of the Children, developed by Jammed Up Studios, published by Fellow Traveler, released September 25th on PS4 and Switch, the 26th on Xbox One for $12.99. Little Bobby's dead, the barbecue is on fire, Jen's eating poisonous berries, and the birthday cake still needs icing. It's just another wonderful day out with the kids in Think of the Children, a frantic parenting simulator for up to 4 players. As you can tell by the giggles, Royal Sefton is here. How are you doing?
I'm honored to be the last one on your show for tonight, and
you have to go home.
I'm laughing because I already play the home game on this one. Thankfully, nobody's died in the barbecue or drowned in the pool or anything else. My kids are not as capricious or as endangered as these children.
Not as ballsy as them to play in the middle of the road.
I'm not sure which.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Win-win either way.
Yes.
So what is Think of the Children besides insane?
Besides insane. Okay, so here's kind of, I can't really call it a parenting sim, but in a way it is, assuming that your kids are Tasmanian devils, I guess. That would be a reasonable assessment of what it is. So it's a good couch type game. You got up to 4 players and you're going to probably need all 4, and I'll get to that in a moment, where you have to corral these children and keep them safe while you do other tasks in the background. You have 6 kids, and the ideal goal is to have all 6 still alive at the end of like 90 seconds. And in those 90 seconds, I can't even keep a straight face trying to tell you this. And in those 90 seconds, you have to not only keep them out of all these hazards, but you got to like flip burgers and apply suntan lotion and shit. All these different tasks based on the level. So you've got, you know, and I've only been to a few levels because another thing I'll get to in a moment, it's really hard to get any unlocks. You've got this beach level, you've got this playground level, you've got a supermarket level, and each of these levels has their own various hazards that you've got to protect your kids from. And at the same time, you've got these different tasks you've got to accomplish based on the level. So the first level you go to is the playground. You've got to flip these burgers before they burn. You've got to set up the picnic tables. You've got to put up a pinata. And the burgers never stop being flipped. So you got to go back and forth between two different barbecues that are set on opposite sides of the playground. Who the hell does that? And flip these burgers back and forth while you're trying to keep kids out of a swimming pool, trying to keep them out of the road, trying to keep them from eating poisonous berries, trying to keep them from killing themselves on a swing, trying to keep them from talking to CPS, and trying to keep them from getting eaten by a dingo.
Amazing.
That's the first level. And in your arsenal, you have the ability to yell at them, which it might take away from your score as a parent. I'm not sure which. It kind of counts how many times you've yelled. You can pick them up. You can throw them, which apparently doesn't endanger them. It just gets them the hell away from whatever it is they were getting into.
Just fucking whip them.
Or you just set them down gently rather than throw them. And yeah, you try to get them just directed away from all of these different hazards. And like I said, the ideal is to have all six children alive. Okay, and that's your multiplier for all the other points that you would acquire based on flipping burgers setting up the table and the pinata. So you get a letter grade based on your score when that's done. And for every death, there's a cheeky, you know, explanation of what happened to them. The swing and a miss, if they fall off the swing and break their head open and die, apparently. Or, you know, they're playing in traffic, or they decided to eat berries that were poisonous, or CPS takes them away. All these different reasons that qualify them as, quote, dead in the game. So if you only have two kids left, your multiplier is basically two on top of any of your base points. And you can see, I don't have a scale for what makes you from an A to an F as far as the letter grade you end up with, but you can see how the multiplier would be very significantly impactful as to whether you pass. So
are you telling me there's letter grades other than F?
There's an F minus, and
because that's what I'm most familiar with.
Well, and I'll tell you something right now. I have not gotten above a D. And the reason I've not gotten above a D is because, as it turns out, kids can't parent. And I have two kids to play this with. And it's not working out real well. You could theoretically play this game single player. I do not recommend that. You are going to find that as an exercise in frustration. So when I said, you know, up to four players and you're probably going to need them, this is like overcooked on meth, okay? You're going to need to get four very well-coordinated people together to actually run a good game here and get them all safe, and you're constantly corralling them. You go to the beach and they're going to get encircled by hammerheads, or a speedboat's going to run over them. You go to the supermarket and they lock themselves in the freezer and die. Just absurd, asinine things happen to them. And as you get further into the game, from what I can tell, you start to get a new scoring mechanic. Like in the supermarket, there's an embarrassment meter based on how misbehaved they are as you run these various items up to the register. You don't have a shopping cart for some reason. You're collecting individual items off the shelf, and you're dropping them up front and then going back to collect more items while you keep your kids from killing themselves on the Drano aisle or whatever it is that one of them poisoned themselves on. It's absolutely bug nuts. This game is, it's a riot, but it is so hard too, because everything happens so fast.
It does. You mentioned the throw mechanic earlier. I wanted to share, I had a fantastic moment where I went to pick up one of my kids and throw them back towards, you know, the middle of the area instead of playing out by the road.
Right.
And I aimed wrong. And I threw it directly into the road where a vehicle immediately came in.
Here, catch.
The timing of just like, oh, child in road, child squashed was incredible. There was zero way to avoid it. It was just directly into the path of an oncoming car. And that's I awesome. Lost it. I absolutely lost it.
Oh my god. Yeah, that's about the size of this game. It's I mean, it's a laugh a minute, but if you actually are trying to win the game, you're going to need to like band together with some very dedicated and coordinated people to play this, I think, and succeed. It whooped our asses so bad. And I don't know. At the same time, it was a lot of fun. I think the kids started to get a little frustrated with it when they realized we couldn't really get beyond a D, no matter how hard we busted our butt. And you need a C minus to move on to the next levels. So that seems to be a common trend as I look through some of the other reviews that some folks are saying, holy crap, dude, so hard. You can't play this by yourself. I would agree.
Yeah, I fully agree. Trying to play it by myself was an exercise in hilarious frustration because it was frustrating trying to get anything accomplished, but I was having so much fun failing.
Yes.
Because it's just so batshit crazy.
It is. It's absolutely nuts. And I went through a couple attempts before realizing I could even dash. You have the ability to run occasionally, and if I had known that, I'd be like, man, I could have saved Timmy. But
no, you couldn't.
Yeah, probably not, actually. Who am I kidding?
You dumb bastard. You weren't going to save anybody.
No. Timmy still dies, even if you run.
So I got to know, $13 on this one. What is your recommendation on it?
If you have folks to play this with that are down for this, I think you're going to have a more fun time than if you have, you know, a couple kiddos or me, myself, and I, and try to just beat your head against the virtual wall. There's so much to commend this game. I mean, it's cute. It's got that like voxely look to it, like Crossy Road or something. Dark sense of humor, of course, a lot of fun, but just super, super hard. So for me, that $13 is worth it if you're really, you know, fully invested in the couch game. And that's not really too high of a price anyway, of course.
No.
Definitely a good laugh fest for sure, though. So yeah, definitely a try it for me.
I agree. If you're throwing a party, I think this might be one of the best games you could have at a party outside of something like Starwall.
There you go.
It's just, I can only imagine having like a dozen people over and taking turns trying to get anything accomplished in the game.
Welcome to my world.
This is something I want to play at MAGFest with just a crowd of people around.
Yes, absolutely.
Speaking of, when are you going to MAGFest again, man?
When are the next Olympics? I don't know, man. I don't know.
We got to get you there. Depends. It's been too long.
It has. It has been way too long. I still have my M4 shirt. I wear that occasionally, and it's still in good shape. Yeah, representing. But, you know what? I don't know. I'm closer to Mag West where I sit right now, but you know, OG Mag Fest is where I'm used to going. So, you know, we'll see. Just gonna save up and hopefully I'll make time for it soon.
One of these days I want to see Royal again. I want to see
these days. Royal.
Yes.
It's now that you have a hair.
Cam Love.
Back in the days when you used to buzz it. And now I'm at the days where I have to buzz it cause I don't have anything.
Breaking sad.
On that note, that is it for this episode. Thanks again to everyone for coming on and chatting with me. It's always fun having you on, Royal. Do you have any final words to end the show?
Can you fly, Bobby?